Greetings. You're listening to the CEIE podcast at Seattle University in the Pacific Northwest of the United States, where life is about making meaning.
This is Michael Retrice with the CEIE podcast, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Professor Greg Magnan, who is a professor of operations management and joined Seattle University in the Albert School of Business and Economics in 1992. He teaches in the undergraduate program, in the MBA and executive programs as well, and in the areas that include creativity and innovation, supply chain management, strategy implementation, and leading organizations within systems. We want to talk about all those, but particularly systems today. That's our main conversation. Welcome, Greg. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michael. It's my pleasure to be here.
So systems, if you don't know anything about systems, sit back and enjoy this conversation in particular, because Greg has a way of discussing and illuminating the way, the manner in which we understand systems in our lives. It's not what you necessarily think it is. And let's start there. Systems are all around us. Every day? In what way is that the case?
The air we breathe, the water we drink is part of a system. The way we move around our towns and cities and villages and highways, transportation system, the communication system, our banking system, education system, judicial system, everything that we work within is a system.
I think about the blood in my body, circulation, my family dynamic, my friendships. Those are all in some way systems.
Interpersonal relationships are systems. As you said, in our bodies, the digestive system and all those parts working together to keep us alive, and how they work together, that's also part of the system. Hmm. These subsystems are combining to form a larger system, ourselves.
Sometimes I just think I'm walking through the universe. I'm just kind of doing my day-to-day thing. But I'm actually, when I think about what you're saying and what we're discussing together, it means that everything is integrated or unintegrated, is passing through or participating in something that is much more complicated than that. What do I do with that information? I mean, in some ways I'm aware of it. In other ways, I'm absolutely unaware and just have no cognizance at all that this is taking place around me.
Yeah, I vacillate between seeing systems everywhere and then being overwhelmed by that. And then I need to back off of that, because you can unpack everything and keep unpacking like a Russian doll, and just there's more in there, and just that's true. And then once it becomes a habit for you to see the system, like, oh, hang on, that's a system at work. It's not an individual who wronged me. To back up and see that's just an event of a larger system, and I should think about that system, not the individual.
Okay. So if if we just take an example of a system, what's one that you like to give where it helps people to understand, all right, this is how a system works and you're participating in it, so that the goal to recognize, right, that's how that happens every day, and people may not even have an understanding in which they're
in an operations setting, operations class, I would talk about a production system, a lean production system.
Okay.
And I think this example of an individual or event shows up well there. So if we're producing something over and over again, we want the quality level to be high. Okay. And if that system, the combination of the raw materials and the skilled labor and the machinery that we use, the management philosophies and the policies and all of that goes into an organization, an error or a defect could be created. In the West, in the U.S. perhaps in particular, we want to find who is the individual to blame for causing that defect.
Okay.
Who's the person? Who made it happen? When in fact, it was somewhere in the system that created that defect. So that ability to back up from a system and say, wait a minute, it's not an individual. They're trying to do their best within that system, yet the system presented them with an out-of-gauge machine, mm-hmm. or poor raw materials, or they're working in their 18th hour of a day. Mm-hmm. That's going to cause some defects.
But that's interesting, because to your point, in the West, we do have a tendency, looking for the one responsible, looking at that kind of blame, first, rather than saying, which it seems much more helpful, like, where in the system is this falling apart? No, who is culpable? Where did that person fall down on the job? The kind of responsibility, for that work ethic that they failed somehow, rather than a failure, to look at it in a much more comprehensive way seems to I don't know, it makes an allowance for something that's much more comprehensive in terms of how it can be fixed too, how it can be repaired, and how we can think of it in a much more kind of in a 360 that allows for how things can be restored, perhaps even.
Yeah, it's a bit of a Band-Aid, isn't it, that we can blame one person and the system is going to be fixed if we remove them. The flip side of that might be if an organization is performing well, it must be because of the top leader.
Right.
The chief officer is the one who made all this work.
Yeah.
When what about the tens of thousands of people who work there? They also may have had a role. Another way to present systems would be the notion of a virtuous cycle, vicious cycle that we may have all heard that term, where good begets good, and just things keep getting better. Or in a negative situation, a bad decision becomes a bad outcome, which forces you to make a bad decision, and that virtuous cycle. So we know those common terms.
Mm-hmm.
Those are straight right out of systems thinking, and we call those reinforcing loops. They can be in a positive way. They can also be in a negative way.
So if I think like in a negative way, I mean, this goes back, in some ways I want to apologize to the listener, but it just gets my mind around this. When I think about even middle school, high school dynamics, you know, we used to go back and be green-lighted by a situation or a rumor starts or something, that kind of negative reinforcing loop, you don't always know like where is that coming from. It seems to be continuing to travel around the same story, the same narrative. You're negatively impacted, and the story continues to loop. It doesn't seem to get outside of that particular rut. That is a negative recurring story or narrative that has that kind of impact.
And it comes back to us. Part of systems is there are feedback loops.
Okay.
Versus an equation, A plus B equals C, and end of story.
Yeah.
Well, C comes back and affects A. So if in that middle school situation you're talking about, well, that bad comes back to me, and then it might affect my confidence.
Yeah.
And my esteem, and then I lay a little lower, and I don't work towards telling a different story or a different narrative. I allow that one to continue because I don't feel strong enough to make a change. And that keeps coming back, and now I feel worse, and now I'm like, you know what, I'm just going to check out.
Yeah.
As a young person. So those negative loops are real and powerful too.
I think of the alternative, like, you know, with what's happening today in clinical therapy, you know, the need for positive reinforcement, where like in DBT therapy, for instance, those positive reinforcement loops where parents can say, hey, you know, you're doing a fine job. No, you're doing a fine job. I keep repeating you're doing a fine job in numerous different ways. And yet doing that has something in terms of positive conditioning that creates the confidence alternatively for a young consciousness that's trying to get above the waterline of their own lives into something new.
That the system responds and provides us feedback is good and bad.
Okay.
And if I think the positive reinforcement is to pay attention to the good parts of the feedback.
Okay.
Because we're going to receive a mixture of positive and negative. And I think sometimes we get focused on the negative and see how all the, you must be thinking bad about me. And so that makes me feel bad about myself. And then, you know, all those, but that also may not be true.
Yeah.
So I think getting people to feel reinforcement and the good vibe from that. I'm not a clinical psychologist, but I think that's part of the power of that technique, that DBT technique.
So when you look at systems and all the work that you do, and all the different kinds of systems, I can't even imagine, what is the goal? Like, what is the goal of a system?
That's a tricky question. The system is going to do its thing. Systems, they are collections of components or parts that are interrelated somehow to achieve an objective. Sometimes we know that objective. Sometimes we don't. If we want an organization to perform well, we want to educate the whole person here at CLU, then that's what that system is supposed to be doing.
Okay.
Does it achieve that goal for every one of our graduates and alums? Probably not. That would be quite a system if it was able to do that and overcome all of the challenges of the system. Achieving that outcome, the system wants to push back in ways that we often don't understand and can't see, and preventing us from reaching whatever the goal of a system may be. We might see glimpses, events that has the system communicating to us that we may overreact to, and make an intervention that makes the overall outcome a little more tricky. One of the things I heard recently about systems is that we often use the phrase like, this thing's broken, the system is broken.
Yeah.
And in fact, the system isn't broken. Huh. It's performing just the way the system wants to perform. It's a collection of things interrelated to achieve some outcome. Huh. We may not like it, but the system is doing fine.
Huh.
Climate change, we often hear people say, oh, I want to protect the Earth. The Earth is going to be around for another 4 billion years of energy or whatever it has in it. Earth is fine. The mammals and the inhabitants, we're going to be a little more affected by the big rock flying around the sun.
Yeah, right. So, okay. So that's, so to your point, we infuse systems with meaning, like the system has our best interest at heart. Maybe not.
Maybe not.
Maybe the system could care less. Are there diabolical systems?
Well, they appear to be diabolical. I think if you spend time in the desert, it seems diabolical.
Right. Yeah. Without water.
Without water, and it's hard there. And part of my travels, I was able to spend time in the Southwest where you grew up.
Okay.
That when you're out there in the desert, it seems barren. It seems brown.
Okay.
And there's nothing happening here.
Yeah.
It seems desolate and terrible. And if you slow down and observe, there's lots of life, and it's hard scrabble. The plants are well dispersed to make sure they have adequate water, but it's an intention. The system has responded in a way that if we're 10 meters apart or whatever the distance is, we can all live.
Yeah.
It's not going to be a dense forest of cacti. It's going to be something more spread out.
Mm-hmm.
But that, I think of a system that's really hard and seems like it wants to hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
The desert is a bit of an example of that.
And, yeah.
But you have to dance with that system a bit, and it's... People have been surviving and thriving there for thousands of years.
So when there is a system that, as you mentioned, if I do want to intervene, if I get into a system and I say, okay, in this system I'm going to attempt an intervention because I want to make it friendlier to me, or perhaps it feels like in this case, no matter how much goodwill I throw at it, I want to intervene on behalf of some higher cause, whatever I think it may be. I'm going to help the system. I'm going to change the system. What happens then?
Well, interventions in system, that's, you asked the question of what do we, or do we intervene? And we intervene all the time. And the benefit of feedback loops are that we get to alter our intervention and learn from them. Peter Senge, who wrote The Fifth Discipline and Necessary Revolution and many, many other books, was talking in the 90s about a learning organization, how organizations can learn. But it's all based on our own individual learning. In fact, the fifth discipline is systems thinking, but the first discipline is personal mastery,
okay,
and getting really good at something. And we get really good at something by doing, making an action, and then seeing how the system responds, and then learning from that.
Okay,
like to become a skier, you don't ski double black diamonds on your first time down the mountain. Hopefully,
yeah,
you have to learn to get up to that. And each time we're intervening, we should be doing an intervention based on what we learned from our last intervention. I've learned you can't grow tomatoes in the foothills of the mountains. There's just not enough sun to do that. Regardless of moving them into the sunny spot or staking them up, it doesn't work. What you have to do is move to where you get more warmer sun. Mm-hmm. When we make interventions without really understanding the system, we're often creating unintended consequences.
Okay.
We thought we were solving or addressing some event that we saw. We made a change, and then we may have made things worse.
How often does this happen?
I would say thousands of times a day.
Wow.
Because people are when we make a decision, we're intervening in a system. It sounds very scientific and engineering-like, but we make thousands of decisions a day.
Okay.
Mostly with incomplete information. And you've heard that term before, incomplete information about what? The system. So we're intervening in a system about which we have incomplete understanding. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, all right.
Lots of things.
Heard that one before.
Yeah. So that it happens is fine. Systems are quite robust. They can deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
They might present a little bit differently, and they might waver a little bit and make things not as great, but it's not going to go extinct.
But that's really important to know as well in the interventions. Others do sense that systems have a kind of perfection, like the mapping. The cartography and what's happening in reality are actually identical, but they're not, right? the system that I see in the world, no matter how much change, how much I want to reach that perfect spot, is never entirely there. Like, systems are imperfect too, right? Aren't they?
They bend and manifest a little bit differently. I think a system actually is perfect.
Okay.
Because it's doing its thing.
Yeah. All right.
Is the outcome perfect in our eyes?
Right.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
But the system is doing its thing. Do we like, is it a perfect outcome for the observer, for the person who is it controlling, in quotes, the system? Maybe, maybe not. And that lack of a desired outcome, we might call that an imperfect or a broken system, when in fact the system is performing well. We have to do different interventions to get it to perform in a band that we're happy with.
You've mentioned Don Meadows before, dancing with systems, this choreography. Like, we have a relationship with that regard with systems. I hear you're referring to here. In this
naturally, I think in once we start naming all the systems around us, the water system and the transportation system, like, oh yeah, I work with those things and I understand sort of at some level of the systems within my body. When we start to break down a system, like we've been talking about the structure of the system, and if we were to make a diagram of that system, a causal loop diagram mm-hmm. or a stock and flow diagram, mm-hmm. we call them, the system gets quite complicated. One of the examples I use is a bathtub, and many systems people do, is drawing a bath. We know how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I joke in class, and then we fill it up right to the top, right? Like, well, no. Well, how do you know that? Because what happens if you do? You get in and water spills.
Mm-hmm.
So you learned that. That system had provided feedback to say, keep it 3 inches below the top. To draw the causal loop diagram of a bathtub is actually quite complicated. Something mm-hmm. as simple as drawing a bath, the model, the manifestation of that is complicated. Then if you try and, like, okay, what's the causal loop diagram of the manufacturing process we were talking about earlier,
mm-hmm.
or an or a educational institution? Wow, very complicated.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this strange yin and yang of systems of, we experience them and intuitively we know how to dance with them. We do it all the time. But then when we try and intellectually break them down and model them so we can craft more effective interventions, that becomes quite complicated and challenging and difficult. And the people who are able to do that are more successful.
It's interesting to me also because family dynamics are systems, relationships are systems, and we don't necessarily have to go there, but you can see how complicated all of this is. I mean, it's a dance through all of this in terms of trying to factor in what are all of the features and factors that should be weighed when I consider all of the little changes that need to be made in order to adjust within a system.
And particularly one that has humans. So my bathtub example is you have full control.
Mm-hmm.
It's one person and the dials of the plumbing. In systems where there are other humans involved, much more complicated. They bring their own bias, their own mental models of how they see the world and maybe how they want that system to work or how our subsystem is going to interface with your subsystem.
Mm-hmm.
Organizational departments, let's say, or silos that might have to begin to work together. The way people make decisions, the policies of the organization, all those are part of the history, the culture, the performance management system,
mm-hmm.
how we see our customers or our suppliers or our constituents or the people that we're serving.
Mm-hmm.
All those are part of the system and their people.
Mm-hmm.
That complicates things.
Yeah.
I think I hear another system operating next to us,
right.
Intervening into our system. What a great little metaphor for talking about systems of a room next door of recording a really nice bass line that is showing up in our system.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? So now we could intervene. We could go knock on the door and say, hey, can you turn that up? That sounds really great.
Right.
Or we could ask them to quiet down, or we could just accept it as part of our system and see
and
that it makes it better.
It.
Flow
yeah.
with it, yeah. A little background music.
I mean, this is interesting because systems require a level of patience and tolerance as well. Sometimes systems go away, sometimes they don't, and sometimes systems are incredibly intrusive. So back to this idea of negative feedback loops or systems that intend negative consequences. Systems that, like we've spoken a lot in our society recently about structural racism. We've talked about systems that intentionally exclude, let's say. And there's books and texts that are out right now that are addressing some of these things. What are your thoughts on that in terms of systems that do this?
Well, I think the books and the people writing and speaking about them are trying to shed some light on the system, on the structure of the system, the policies and the people and the mental models and the laws, the changes to the legal system that have been in place and the banking system in many cases, and clearly the judicial system. They're trying to bring some attention so people will work to change those, change those systems, either affecting people's individual biases, or let's go change laws and hold different groups more accountable than perhaps they have been in the past, whether they be officers or bankers or representatives or other humans, to try and change the, you know, that even the term structural racism speaks to a system. That structure of the system is producing an outcome repeatedly, and waving your hands and saying this isn't right. Guess what? The system's not changing. So to change the outcomes of structural racism, the pattern of behavior over time of that, making a statement or responding to an event is inadequate. How to, and I think these are what the writers are saying, we need to change the laws and the hearts and the minds and the bias, changing the elements of the system to change the output of the system.
I want to make sure the listener understands that distinction also that you're making. And you mentioned earlier a book in our conversation, Braiding Sweetgrass, maybe as an example of that. And I don't know if you want to refer to that again, but there's the mental model, that word, that phrase you've used, what happens in mental models where biases get lodged. If you could say more about that too for the listener, what is that in society, and what do we need to recognize about that that's different in terms of the work we really have to do in terms of developing a greater awareness?
Well, thanks for asking that question, because the mental models are the hidden gem and the most complicated factor. The phrase winning the hearts and minds is trying to change people's mental models. In Robin Wall Kimmerer's book, Braiding Sweetgrass, she talks about the native perspective on nature.
Okay.
In some of our, on a sabbatical a couple of years ago, I had the good fortune to drive around this wonderful country and see a lot of it. A lot of what you see is extraction, resource extraction. And whether it's a mining operation or monoculture or whatever it might be, it's big and it's scarring on the earth. Who's benefiting from that resource extraction? Very few people, and then it's going to go away. They're going to use up that. Maybe you ask, do systems die? I suppose the system, the resources been extracted. That part of the system may be dead. Versus the mental model of the indigenous people who have lived here for thousands of years, take what you need and be grateful for it, and then take only what you need. Come back the next year, take only what you need, and have it be around for generations. That's a different mental model than a for-profit, economic, cut all the trees down, take all the ore, do whatever to satisfy the needs of 1,000 shareholders versus the needs of a civilization. So that notion of what we believe, the financial crisis of 2008, 2007, 2008, depending on you think it started, was that the fault of the borrowers or the fault of the lenders?
Right.
When I ask people in class, they're like, yes, both. Okay. Was it 50-50? Right. Is it 10-90? Yeah,
who had to sell their house?
Yeah.
Short sale.
And so there was a bunch of drivers of that. But the mental model is sort of, that goes back to, is it an individual's fault? Or was the system, but even the people who were writing the loans and working for mortgage companies, did they feel great about giving a loan to somebody that they knew they couldn't pay back? Probably not, I would say. But they have a quota. They have a family to feed. It's a complicated system, but the mental models of who's to blame, the answer is everybody, and maybe more on one side than the other, my own personal mm-hmm. perspective on that. But it's how we, you know, if you were raised where personal responsibility is everything, mm-hmm. then you think it was the person taking the loan.
Yeah.
If your mental model is different, you might say, oh, it was the financial industry that was the culprit mm-hmm. In this. So it's that the mental model, it's our bias. It's how we were raised. It's the news that we consume, the people that we mm-hmm. hang out with and communicate with and hear their perspective and value those perspective. All that comes together mm-hmm. to form our mental models. They're very powerful. Dawn Meadows says if you want to change the system, she has a really great list of 11. And I don't know if you have resources on your podcast. We can
add that.
We could link to that of the most powerful ways to or areas to make change in a system, to intervene in a system. And the most powerful is the mental model level of that hearts and minds, is to get people to see, oh, there is structural racism mm-hmm. here. I should change my, like, it's not that. It's this whole other thing mm-hmm. over here that's producing this outcome and this unfairness. Mm-hmm. That we may see.
We can certainly provide that. And I also think, you know, to your point, then it means that there's patterns underneath this, and this image that we've discussed before about an iceberg. And often, you know, what's happening in popular culture and what we see above the waterline is just so is so transparent. It's kind of gleaming above the waterline. It's the easiest thing to see, to mm-hmm. point to and say, aha, that's the problem. He or she is to blame. And that goes back to your first point. You know, we're always kind of looking, where's the fault, let's say.
Yeah.
But all of that mass underneath, all of those patterns of consequence and systems, all of that is so much harder to see. It's so less opaque. That's heavy lifting to ask a lot of people to do.
It's heavy lifting. It's the hardest work.
Yeah.
But for dynamic leaders, though, to get people to see a new outcome, and I think this is where clinical psychologists are quite brilliant too, is to get people to change behavior.
Okay.
It's probably the hardest thing.
Yeah.
They're changing their mental model and how they interact themselves and how they process information and decide to actually do something. That level is the most powerful. To get people to move off of their mental model or to change their behavior, that's a heavy lift, as you said.
Yeah.
Probably the heaviest, and that's why that's the biggest place for change. That notion of the iceberg, events are what are the tip of the iceberg, as we know that phrase. And then below there is the rest of the system. So there's an event is a single thing. If you map all those events over time, you get a behavior over time graph.
Okay.
It's the systems people say. And that's the system saying, here's how I behave. Here's how I respond.
Okay.
Below that is the structure of the system. And those are the policies and the elements. If we're looking at a water system in a watershed of that mm-hmm. system, right? It's the slope, it's the soil, it's the rock, it's the trees, mm-hmm. it's the valley. All those things are working together, but it's sort of the how they work together. Mm. And you can't just change the tree types and get a different outcome of the system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe a little bit slight, but it's all those the things we can't see mm-hmm. are really the complicated part of the structure of a system, particularly a human system.
Mm-hmm.
That trying to make those changes. I know some people who do organizational change, they want to do a map of who are all the stakeholders
mm-hmm.
and individual humans or groups of humans. And we're trying to understand what is their role in the system. Well, if I need to make this change, I need to talk to her and she can influence mm-hmm. him. And that will allow me to move this, to intervene in the system in a way that will move it towards the goal that I want. But is it my goal or is it your goal? Whose goal is it of the system? That's we were coming back to that earlier conversation. And this is where leaders who can, either in the public domain or in an organization, to get people to move to that, to change structural racism and to write about it and talk about it, we need to energize people to change their behavior.
Yeah.
And having a powerful vision is what can help people to change their hearts and minds, change their mental models of why I should work hard and sacrifice to make this change.
Some changes we're talking about take generations. Transgenerational change. Are humans able to do that, to see patterns that can sustain a kind of effort toward change. That's disruptive in a system. As you've said, sometimes even our best intentions create negative consequences. But are we able to sustain an effort that produces positive impact in a way that's worth doing that kind of heavy lifting together?
What a simple question you've asked. You know, on my good days, I say yes, and on all the other days, I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
I think climate change is a great model, a laboratory for that question.
Yeah.
Are we able to make change now to prevent a more than 1.5 degree change in average temperature? And people seem unwilling to make changes today. Humans are very hard at. It's difficult for us to predict the future.
Yeah,
it's not a skill that we have that makes it more challenging to play this long game. I think the indigenous cultures that were able to, it's quite incredible.
Yeah,
to the whole notion of a seventh generation that I'm living today, such that the seventh generation from now will have it the same way. Mm-hmm. That's powerful.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we're able to even think 7 years from now, mm-hmm. not to mention seven generations. It's difficult for people to see the future. We've been talking about interventions. It's not so simple as you push the button or you change the volume control on the electronics and it goes up. Mm-hmm. And when you intervene in a system, it takes we call it a delay loop. There's a delay before that intervention is going to show up in the pattern of behavior over time graph.
Mm-hmm.
And that delay for humans is difficult. If you hit your thumb with the hammer, it's going to hurt right away.
Mm-hmm.
But if there was a delay loop in there and suddenly 3 weeks later your thumb started hurting really bad, how come?
Mm-hmm.
Was it the car door? Was it the mm-hmm. hammer? Who knows what the cause was? And that makes it difficult for us to learn cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
If they're separated in time, the effect we're seeing, the event, the change in the pattern of behavior over time graph, what was the cause of that? Mm-hmm. And the further back it is, the more challenging, and the further out our changes need to be. I mean, that, you know, COP28 being led by a leader of a petrol fossil fuel state.
Yeah.
That's a system at work, isn't it?
It sure
it's
is.
It's a system that, you know, is the system broken? Not for some players.
Yeah.
System's working just fine.
Yeah.
And I think your question is a good one. Can we get enough people to see a better outcome, a more just outcome, a fairer outcome for more people and make change today? A lot of the changes, it's going to require personal sacrifice.
Yeah.
That's hard for people. We're not talking about the psychologist to get people to change behavior. That's what it's going to take is a behavior change.
Yeah.
And when will people change their mental model? Like, oh, my consumption is affecting human life and quality in other parts of the world? I hadn't thought about that.
And that's a really important point, because part of the iceberg we're talking about is the interior one. Like, you can look deep within and see those patterns. There's that mental model biases that are attributive there. That kind of inner resourcing is also a part of the personal commitment that is required by each one of us in our own leadership and the systems that govern our lives, the ones that mm-hmm. we can see, our families, our communities, the ways we show up with our occupation, our profession, our vocation, whatever language we use to describe the commitments that we carry with us every day and every week throughout the year.
Yeah, and the feedback we get from those.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how long can you keep up your conviction with... You know, publishing is hard, right? You get a bunch of negative feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for the people who do creativity and in the advertising business, mm-hmm. mostly what they get is no.
Yeah.
A baseball player who can hit 300, that is hugely successful. That means they 70% of the time they're failing.
Yeah.
And that's success.
Yeah.
And if we like, 70% failure rate, not too many people or organizations are going to consider that as a good outcome. So that feedback we're getting on our integrity of our commitment is it lifts us up, it fuels us to go do more or perhaps as we were talking about the middle schooler, it breaks us down and has our commitment wavering perhaps.
Critical, right, to be able to pay attention to those feedback loops.
And we don't, and that's part of systems thinking too, I think, is to know that they're there.
Yeah.
That we are, all through our educational system, we have been, we learned a linear system, mm-hmm. a left to right, A plus B equals C, but systems feedback. Mm-hmm. You make an intervention and you should, this is the patience thing you mentioned was quite wise. Do we have the patience to let that intervention play out and let the system absorb it? And like, okay, now it's part of me, and here's the pattern of behavior over time based on this new system. Because you made an intervention, you have changed the system. That's mm-hmm. what we're doing. Can we wait long enough to let that play out before we start making other mm-hmm. changes? When you do the scientific method suggests you change one variable at a time mm-hmm. to see what's happening. Mm-hmm. And the dynamic complexity of systems make it difficult, even if you are patient enough to wait. Was the outcome really because of your intervention or some other, was it somebody playing bass in the room next door?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Maybe that was the thing.
Maybe that was the thing, however good it was,
yeah.
right? I'm here today with Professor Greg Magnan. Thank you so much for your time, for joining us, a conversation about systems. You'll see also that there's a link below. You can learn more about the resource that was identified. We ask you to follow us at the center. More podcasts and more information for the good of the listener. Thanks again.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You've been listening to the CEIE podcast at SU. Visit our Theolab at religica.org or the renowned International Journal of Local Stories from around the world at theinterfaithobserver.org and participate in emerging opportunities at our main website at seattleu.edu/CEIE. Thank you.